I hope you got your rest, little Guile.
The speaker was a blackguard woman named Samite. She was stationed with Kip near the back of their column of blackguards. The Gallius had just arrived at Big Jasper this morning, and the blackguards were the first off.
It's going to be a long day for you.
Rest? Kip had been trying to figure out how to conceal his big secret, his inheritance, the last and only gift his mother had ever given him. He had a large, ornate, jeweled white dagger that no one knew about, and he had a large, ornate, polished dagger box. He could put the dagger in the dagger box, of course, but some paranoid corner of his brain was certain that the first thing a person would ask when they saw the box was if he would open it. How could he say no? So, late into the night, he'd sat in his little bunk in the darkness, trying not to wake the blackguard sleeping in the other bunks. He'd found twine, and he tied the dagger to his back, a process that took a good 10 minutes with his bandaged hand. Its point hung down to his butt, under his clothes, held in place by his belt. It wasn't a great solution, but it was the best he could come up with. After his night, a long day was just what he needed now. Still, he mustered a rueful smile for Samite. She was nice. Despite her crooked, oft-broken nose and prominently missing front tooth, she was short and solid as a seawall. They were some of the last to join the column. At once formed up, the blackguard set off at a slow jog. Kip thought that he wouldn't be quite as awestruck the second time he saw the Chromeria. He was wrong. He was still awed even by Big Jasper Island, which was entirely covered by a city. The city was all multicolored domes on top of whitewashed square buildings. Every intersection was adorned with a tower, at the top of which hung a mirror, polished and geared so that the mirror could direct sunlight, or even moonlight, into any part of the city. The thousand stars, they called them. The streets were laid out in straight lines with mathematical precision so as to cut off as few beams of light as possible.
There is no darkness on Big Jasper, they like to say. Not literally true, but more true here than anywhere else in the world.
Kip nodded, saving his air for the jogging. In simply looking over at her for an instant, he almost collided with a black-robed Luxiot. The streets were packed with thousands of people. Not for market day or any particular holy day, this was normal for Big Jasper. And the people themselves came from every arc of the seven satrapies. Red-haired pale savages from deep within the Blood Forest to woolen doublet-wearing midnight Elysians, light-skinned Hrothgari in their wide straw hats to shield them from the sun. Abornian men and women, virtually indistinguishable from each other in their layers of silks and earrings. But regardless of their lineage, the people on the streets had one thing in common. They're all for the blackguards with whom Kip was jogging. People got out of the way for them, and the blackguards took it as their due. At first, Kip tried not to look too conspicuously out of place among all the hard-muscled physiques around him, but soon he was just trying to keep up.
Don't worry. If you can't keep up, we have orders to carry you.
Carry me?
The mortification of the mental image was enough to keep Kip going. Plus, if they carried him, they'd discover the dagger. Finally, they crossed the Lily Stem, the transparent blue and yellow Luxon-covered bridge between Little Jasper Island and Big Jasper Island. Iron Fist gave some sort of signal that Kip didn't see as the blackguards came into the great yard between the six outer towers of the Chromeria, and the troop disappeared in half a dozen different directions. Kip leaned over with his hands on his knees.
Concealed weapons are most useful if you can draw them on short notice.
Of course. Leaning forward had pressed the outline of the dagger against his clothes, and because of their work, of all people, blackguards would be the best at noticing concealed weapons.
Excellent, Kip. Outstanding. You couldn't even hide the dagger for 1 hour.
Still, she said nothing further. Kip looked after the departing blackguards. Iron Fist was gone too.
What am I supposed to do?
I'll take you to your new quarters, and then to your lectures.
Kip's stomach dropped. A class full of people who all knew each other and would stare at him when he came in. He'd be dropped into the middle of some subject he knew nothing about, and he'd look stupid.
I've seen sea demons, faced color whites, been in battle, and killed, and I'm nervous about being the new boy.
He followed Samite up into the central tower, up one of the counterweighted lifts.
You get the layout before?
The commander took me straight to the threshing, not really.
We don't have time today, sadly. I like watching the fresh meat gawk. In short, each tower houses its own color of drafters and most of the training facilities for them, though everyone shares some barracks, some offices, some storerooms, some libraries. At the base of each tower, there are more specialized functions. Under the blue tower are the smelters and glass furnaces. Under the green are gardens and menageries. Under the red is the mirth hall and conservatories. Under the yellow is the infirmary and discipline areas. Under sub-red are the kitchens and the stockyards. Under the prism's towers is the great hall. Got it?
He hoped she was joking. He smiled uncertainly as they stepped out into an empty level, not far up. She walked him down the hall and opened an oak door to a barracks.
Find an empty bed.
There was no one inside, empty pallets stretching from wall to wall. At the foot of each one was a chest for personal items.
Please tell me there isn't some kind of pecking order for who gets what bed.
There isn't some kind of pecking order for who gets what bed.
You're lying.
Correct.
What's the worst bed in the room?
In the back, farthest from the door.
Kip began walking to the last bed when he realized something.
I don't really have any stuff. What?
You're not going to class armed.
Oh, hell.
We'll also be taking you to the tailor's to get your Chromeria garb.
What was he supposed to do? Leave a priceless dagger in a barracks? Samite only knew that he had a knife. They just left a war zone, so that was no surprise. But if he showed it to her, she'd surely report it. He had to make it uninteresting, even to her.
I'm going to, have to take off my shirt to get my knife off. Can you turn your back?
She turned her back, without even making any cracks or grinning. Kip moved quickly to his pallet and stripped off his shirt and untied the dagger. He pulled the shirt back on and folded his cloak clumsily. He opened the chest. Inside was a thin folded blanket. Kip set the cloak and the dagger box into his chest and put the chest at the foot of the bed.
Done yet?
Just a minute.
Kip looked over the beds. There were maybe 60 pallets in the room. The unoccupied beds, those nearest Kip, were unmade and had the chest underneath them. The occupied beds were made and had the chest at the foot. There were no hiding places, just as there was no privacy. Kip tucked the dagger under the mattress. He made the bed quickly, trying to smooth out the wrinkles so the lump wasn't obvious. Then he started walking back toward Samite.
So you know, best way to get something stolen is to hide it under your mattress. It's where the bullies and thieves always look first.
Oh, I'm terrible at this. I should have told my father about the dagger. Even if he took it away from me, that would have been better than having some 16-year-old butt fungus steal it. Damn it, mother! Couldn't you have given me a locket?
Kip went back to his pallet, grabbed the dagger, and looked around. He walked down 5 rows to one of the unoccupied pallets, opened the chest under that bed, and tucked the knife under the blanket. Better than nothing. He slid the chest back under the bed, grimacing.
Fantastic. What's next?
Next was the tailor's, where Kip had to strip down for the fitting. The tailors were women. One of them was attractive, and as she knelt in front of him, standing in his underwear, he could see straight down her cleavage. He spent the next half hour staring at the ceiling and praying. And just when Kip was finally leaving, thanking Orholim that his body hadn't done anything to mortify him, the other woman came up to him.
Ahem.
She handed him an extra pair of clean underwear.
You can wash them once in a while. And your armpits, too.
He almost died. They made him go sponge bathe. He angrily waved off the slave who tried to help him and change into his new white tunic and new white pants and new underwear, and a tower slave took his clothes to the barracks. Then they went and registered with some official who made Kip sign his name on a bunch of forms, and then Semi took him to the dining hall where he was allowed a very small and very fast lunch. And then she showed him where the toilets were on each level of the towers. And then she took him to his first class.
I can come inside or I can wait outside. Your choice.
Outside, please, outside.
He was already embarrassed enough that he had a bodyguard. Kip looked into the lecture hall, trying to hide his nerves, while other students streamed past him.
Anything I should, know?
You're expected not to know anything.
Ah, then I might even exceed expectations.
Every time you draft, you're hastening your death.
Magister Kadah wasn't yet middle-aged, but she already seemed wizened, mousy, with hunched shoulders, hair that hadn't seen a brush or a pick in weeks, green spectacles on a gold chain around her neck, and a thin switch of green Luxon in her hand.
Your death doesn't matter, but depriving your satrap of an expensive tool does. Your death doesn't matter, but depriving your community of what it needs to survive does. We who draft are slaves. Slaves to Orholum, to light, to the prism, the satraps, and our cities.
Cheery sort.
Kip tried to keep his expression neutral as he sat in on his first class at the Chromeria.
Lies first, lessons later.
What?
Kip looked over his shoulder. The boy was, oddly, wearing clear spectacles with thick black mahogany frames in front of thicker black brows. The lenses made one eye look bigger than the other. But more intriguing than his Hrothgari looks, curly light brown hair, small nose, tan skin, brown eyes, were the mechanical spectacles themselves. Two colored lenses, one yellow, one blue, rested on hinges, ready to be clicked down over the clear lenses at a moment's notice. The boy grinned, seeing Kip stare.
It's my own design. It's genius. I've never...
Kip almost jumped out of his skin. He looked at the green Luxon switch in the Magister's hand. She'd slammed it across his desk, missing his fingertips by a thumb's width.
Master Guile! Do you think you're better than the rest of the class, Master Guile?
The temptation was strong, but Kip had his orders. He was to do well in his classes. Getting kicked out of them would not help him achieve that.
No, Magister!
She wasn't an imposing figure, neither tall nor wide, but she loomed over Kip's seat. He leaned as far away as his seat allowed.
Do we understand each other, young man?
Yes, Magister.
Discipule! I'm sure you've noticed your new classmate. His name is Kip Guile, and...
A Kip. Not a woody tub for toys, a tubby wooden boy.
Kip knew it was a mistake as soon as the words were halfway out of his mouth.
Ah, thank you. I'd forgotten that gutter Tyrian has its own definitions for words. Put out your hand, Kip.
Kip extended his hand.
Don't ever interrupt a Magister, Kip, even if you are a Guile.
Magister Kadat turned and walked back toward the front of the room.
Kip, ridiculous name. But then what can one expect an illiterate slattern to name her bastard?
It was a trap. Kip knew it was a trap. It yawned open right in front of his feet.
She hates you and she has a plan, Kip. Just keep your mouth shut, Kip.
He raised his hand. It was the best compromise his brain could negotiate with his mouth. She didn't call on him. He kept his left hand up. Wrapped in white bandages, it was impossible to miss.
As you all should remember from yesterday's lecture, drafting is the process of turning light into a physical substance. Luxin.
She saw that Kip's hand was still up, and her mouth tightened momentarily, but she ignored him.
Each color of light can be transformed into a different color of Luxin, each of which has its own smell, weight, solidity, strength. Kip, are we wasting your time? Are we boring you?
Trap, Kip. Don't do it, Kip. No, my eyes glaze over like this all the time. Comes from having a mother who was always smoking haze.
Her eyebrows shot up.
I have this condition. Stop it, Kip. Stop. See, I'm not just fat. I'm also slow. Mentally. So when I get fixated on one thing, I'm not able to go on to the next subject until all my questions are answered. Maybe I'm not advanced enough for this class. Maybe I should be moved somewhere else.
I do see. Well, Master Guile, this is a novice class, and we pride ourselves on not leaving behind even the slowest cattle in the herd. And obviously, you really want to say something, don't you?
Yes, Magister.
She smiled. It was a deeply unpleasant smile. Small woman, so pleased to be the mistress of her domain, so proud to bully a class full of children.
Then I'll make you a deal, Kip. You say whatever you want. But if I find it impertinent, I'll smack your knuckles again. You see, class, this would be a nice object lesson, an analog for drafting. There's always a price, and you have to decide if you are willing to pay it. So, Kip?
You called my mother illiterate, and that's about as true as me calling you a decent human being. My mother sold her soul to Haze. She lied and cheated and stole. I think she even whored herself a few times, but she wasn't illiterate. So if you're going to slander my mother to make me look pathetic, there's plenty of true things you can say, but that is not one of them.
You bitch.
Are you quite finished?
Yes.
Kip put his hand on the desk for her to smack. His left hand, wrapped in bandages.
Stupid Kip, you're just daring her, asking for it.
The switch slammed into the table so hard it made the surface jump, just two thumbs away from his hand.
Klaus, sometimes with drafting, as with life, you don't have to pay the price for misbehaving, especially if you're a guile. Kip, I don't like your attitude. Go wait in the hall.
Kip stood and walked out into the hall, followed by 20 pairs of eyes. His fellow students were from all over the Seven Satrapies. Dark-skinned Pareans, the girls with hair free, the boys wearing gotras, olive-skinned Atashians with sapphire-bright eyes, and lots of Hrothgari, small-nosed, thin-lipped, and lighter-skinned, one even a blonde. Kip was the only Tyrian, though he looked more mutt than anything. Hair kinky like a Parean, but without the lean, fluid build. Eyes blue like an Atashian, but skin darker than their olive complexions, nose not prominent. He even had a few freckles visible through his skin, like he was part Blood Forester.
They'll hate you for me, but don't worry. Eventually they'll hate you for you too.
It was his first day, so Kip was guessing he was being hated for Gavin Guile this time. Samite was gone when he got out into the hall. Kip supposed the Blackguards worked on shifts. She'd probably thought he could get through one lecture without getting in trouble.
Oops.
He sat on the floor in the Chromeria's hall.
Go ahead. Feel sorry for yourself. You've been acknowledged as a bastard of the most powerful man in the world. He saved your life many times, and he gave you the choice. You could have entered the Chromeria anonymously. You chose this.
Kip had thought he'd have at least one friend here, though. Liv had been here, until Garriston. She'd been nice to him, though she saw him as a little brother. But now she was gone, fighting for the Color Prince, choosing to believe comforting lies. Kip hated her for that, despised her for seeking the easy way out. But most of all, he missed her. He sat close to the door, trying to overhear Magister Kadaz's lecture, trying to think about magic so he didn't think about anything else. Magister was saying something about the properties of Greenluxon. He thought about trying to draft some right here in the hall. It would be a bad idea, though. Green made you wild, made you disregard authority. Now would be a bad time for that. He smiled, though, thinking about it.
Are you Kip?
The speaker was a tiny, clean-shaven, very dark Parian man in a starched headscarf and a slave's robe of fine cotton.
Yes?
The man eyed him for long moments, clearly judging him, but not letting the verdict show in his face. Andros Gael's head slave and right hand was named Grinwoody, Gavin had told Kip.
Lux Lord Guile requests your presence.
Lux Lord Guile, as in Andros Guile, one of the richest men in the world, with estates throughout Hrothgar, Blood Forest, and Perea. On the ruling council known as the Spectrum, he was the Red, father of two Prisms, Gavin and the rebel who'd almost destroyed the world, Dazen. Andros Guile was the only man in the world Gavin Guile feared.
Grandfather.
And Kip was a bastard, a blot on the family honor. Felia Guile, Kip's grandmother and the only person who could massage Andros Guile's tyranny, was now dead. But before Kip ran face first into that wall, he had another problem. He couldn't leave the hall without giving Magister Kadaz fresh reasons to hate him, and he couldn't show Andros Guile disrespect by making him wait.
Will you tell my Magister that I've been summoned?
Grinwoody looked at him, expressionless. He opened his mouth to explain himself, remembered Gavin's orders.
Remember who you are.
He was going to apologize or say please, but he stopped himself. After another moment of weighing Kip, Grinwoody acquiesced. He rapped on the door and stepped into the classroom.
Lux Lord Guile requires Kip's presence.
He didn't give Magister Kadaz a chance to respond, though Kip would have given his left eye to see the expression on her face. Grinwoody was a slave, but a slave authorized to do his duty by one of the most powerful men in the world. Nothing the Magister said mattered. Grinwoody was a man who remembered who he was. The real question was, who was Kip? Grinwoody had referred to him only by his first name. What had Gavin said?
We'll count it a victory if you avoid wetting yourself.
You mind if we stop by the privies on the way?
Gavin smiled as he stepped off the skimmer onto Sears Island. Karis had her Attican drawn and was pointing her pistol at the nearest man. The people stood in an unruly mob, but they were armed with swords and muskets, makeshift spears. There were commonalities between them. They had come from all seven satrapies, light-skinned and dark, dirty and clean, dressed in silk and wool. Several had an extra eye drawn on their forehead with kohl, though even among those, some had exquisitely drawn, others rough, lopsided. What these men and women had in common was only this. Each one had the religious devotion to cross reefs in a small outrigger canoe to get here, and every one of them was a drafter. A woman stepped through the crowd. She was little, barely taller than Gavin's waist, arms and legs short, her trunk the size a woman of average height would have. She had a flaring eye tattoo exquisitely on her forehead.
You will not draft here.
I'll decide that.
It is as foretold.
Sears. Excellent. Someone foretold that I'd say that?
No, but you'd be an asshole.
I think I'm going to like this place.
You'll come with us.
Sure.
It wasn't a request.
Yes, it was. When you don't have powers to compel obedience, by definition, you're making a request. What's your name?
Celia. When I tire, you'll carry me.
Happy to.
Karis pointed her pistol straight at Celia's third eye tattoo. The other men pointed their muskets at Karis and cocked them.
Try anything, and I'll hollow out your skull.
Ah, the white blackguard. We were told you'd be forceful.
Karis uncocked her pistol and tucked it away, sheathed her sword.
I've changed my mind. Who are you taking me to see, and how far away is she?
The third eye resides at the base of Mount Inura.
Gavin pointed to the tallest mountain. It was green, not so tall that it had a tree line, but still quite a walk.
What is that? A 5-hour walk from here?
6.
Don't suppose you have horses?
We have some few horses, but one walks when one goes to see the third eye. It is a pilgrimage. It gives one time to reflect and prepare the soul for the meeting.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the third eye comes to see me, she can ride. I want her to be in the right frame of mind.
So it was foretold.
She foretold I wouldn't come?
No. Still the asshole part.
If it helps, I'm not being capricious. I've work to do. I'll be here doing it.
Celia looked around at the 200 armed men who surrounded Gavin and Karis.
I could insist, you know. These men are not just armed, they are drafters too.
I'm the prism. Do you think 200 men can keep me from doing what I will?
I think you seek out conflict needlessly.
Hear, hear.
Sometimes Gavin thought the world was full of morons. Power could be a knife, but often it had to be a bludgeon. A man like Commander Iron Fist could speak gently because simply by standing, he overawed other men with his physical presence. Gavin had to draw lines and enforce them because he didn't trust others to do it for him. He had to do it because if others were allowed to start basing their decisions on the assumption that he was weak, it would take blunt force to get them to change their minds. Deterrence is cheaper than correction. But what he'd said about will wasn't thrown in heedlessly. Drafters always impose their will on the world. The most powerful drafters always included more than their share of madmen, bastards, divas, and assholes. And because everything depended on them, they were tolerated. Gavin, most of all. But the more power you have, the harder it is to recognize what's beyond your power. And there was a pleasure in seeing others do what you want. Gavin felt it now as Celia gave orders, rounding up her men and leaving. He could tell himself that it was important to establish the power dynamic because of what he had to do, and to prepare the Sears for the bitter pill that they were going to have to swallow. That was true, but he had to watch himself too. Before they were even gone, Gavin headed back down the beach. He left the skimmer sealed.
We have 1 week. This bay is too wide, so we'll need to build seawalls off that point and from there to there. I'm going to have to clear out the reefs. I'm thinking of clearing them in a zigzag pattern so that if an invading navy comes here, they'll be destroyed, but we'll have marked the safe way so that the locals can direct traffic. Buoys that can be moved. I also haven't decided how wide the safe path should be. If it's too narrow, you keep supplies from getting into the city, and it simply becomes too expensive for many people to live here. But too open, and the reefs no longer serve as a deterrent. So your thoughts are more than welcome. Other than that, I'll need your help prioritizing what things I need to build to give my people a running start. Do we clear the jungle? And if so, how? Do we need to build a wall against the native animals? Against the native people? Should we try to build any houses, or would that be too much work?
You know, every time I think I know you, you're really doing this, aren't you? You're founding a city, not just a village. You're planning for it to be a major center.
Not during my life.
You know, if you keep changing everything you touch, nothing's going to be the same 5 years from now.
5 years. It was supposed to be the remainder of his term as Prism, but he was already dying. And pretty soon, Karras would notice.
No, I hope it's not.
5 years, and 5 great purposes left. Except now, he only had 1 year.
Ugh. The only thing this place needs to make it creepier is cobwebs blowing in the wind.
Kip stared into the pitch black of Lord Androscale's room with something less than glee.
You're letting in light? Are you trying to kill my lord?
No, I'm... I'm always apologizing. I'm coming in.
Kip stepped forward through several layers of heavy tapestries that blocked light from the room. The air inside the room was stale, still, hot. It reeked of old man, and it was impossibly dark.
Come here.
Kip moved forward with little steps. Sure, he'd trip and disgrace himself. It was like a dragon's den. Something touched his face. Not a cobweb. A feathery light touch. Kip stopped. He had somehow expected Androscale to be an invalid, seated in a wheeled chair perhaps, like a dark mirror of the white. But this man was standing. The hand was firm, though with few calluses. It traced Kip's chubby face, felt the texture of his hair, the curve of his nose, pressed his lips, went against the grain of Kip's incipient beard.
So, you're the bastard.
Yes, my lord.
Kip crashed into the wall so hard he would have broken something if it hadn't been covered in layers of tapestries too. He fell to the carpeted floor, his cheek burning, ears ringing.
That was for existing. Never shame this family again.
Kip stood unsteadily, too surprised to even be angry. He didn't know what he had been expecting, but a blow out of the darkness hadn't been it.
My apologies for being born, my lord.
You have no idea.
Whatever you do, don't make him an enemy.
Get out!
Get out now.
Kip left, having the distinct feeling that he'd failed. The color prince was rubbing his temples. Liv Danavis couldn't take her eyes off of him. No one could. The man was practically carved of pure Luxon. Blue plates covered his forearms, made spiky gauntlets for his fists. Woven blue Luxon made up much of his skin, with yellow flowing in rivers beneath the surface, constantly replenishing the rest. Flexible green Luxon made up his joints. Only his face was human, and barely at that. His skin was knotted with burn scars, and his eyes, halos so broken as to be absent, were a swirl of every color, not just his irises, but the whites as well. Right now, those scleras swirled blue, then yellow, as he sat on the great chair in the audience chamber of the Travertine Palace, deciding how to split up the city he just conquered, and found nearly empty.
I want the 12 Lords of the Air to oversee redistribution of the city. Lord Shyam will preside. First, the plunder. Those who fled Garriston took almost nothing with them. It's all here. Some of it will travel with the army, but the rest shouldn't be left to rot. Sell what can be sold and distribute the rest in the most equitable way possible among the remaining Garristonians. The 12 lords are to decide who among the new settlers will be given leases to which properties. The richer areas and homes will require a fee up front. The poorer will be allowed 6 months before they begin paying. Lady Celine?
He turned to a blue-green bichrome who hadn't yet broken the halo. She was Tyrian, with wavy dark hair and a dusky complexion. Striking, but odd. Eyes too far apart. Small mouth. She curtsied.
You're in charge of all the greens until we leave the city. 6 weeks. In that time, I expect you to dredge the key irrigation canals and repair the locks on the river. I want this city to flower next spring. The first rains of autumn may come any day. Consult with Lord Shyam. New plants will need to be brought in. Perhaps soil as well. Do what you can with the labor provided in the time we have.
Lady Celine curtsied deeply and left immediately. And on it went all morning. Liv sat among five advisors till the Color Princess left. Other than those advisors, no one else was allowed into the Great Hall. The Prince wanted few people to see the entirety of his plans. Why Liv was one of the privileged few, she had no idea. She was the daughter of General Corvin Danavis, and the Color Prince had made no secret of the fact that he hoped he could recruit Gavin's old enemy to his side. But Liv thought it was more than that. She'd switched sides before the Battle of Garriston, even fighting for the army trying to reclaim the city. But she'd done it in return for the Color Prince saving her friends. She didn't deserve this kind of trust. But she did find the whole thing fascinating. Often the prince would call forth a courtier to give him more information on some point. He cared nothing for previous laws, and little for how things had been done traditionally, but he showed a keen interest in commerce and trade and taxation and agriculture, all the things needed to provide for his people and his army. Summoning his military commanders, he elevated one of his most talented young commanders to general, and then tasked him with securing Tyria's roads and rivers. He wanted trade to be able to flow unfettered up and down the whole of the Umber River, and bandits to be stamped out mercilessly. In some ways, Liv knew, it was merely trading many bandits for one. The prince's men would doubtless collect taxes, just as the bandits charged passage fees. But if they did it fairly and didn't murder the farmers and traders for their goods, the country would still be better off, whatever you called it. He set more greens and yellows to clear the river itself, under their own command. If the prince was a bad man, he was a bad man taking a long view, because even though Liv didn't understand everything that he was ordering, it was clear to her that he was sacrificing a huge number of his drafters and fighting men for the benefit of Tyria. In the long run, her cynical superviolet nature told her, that would benefit him. An army on the march doesn't make its own food and can't always count on plunder to pay its men. So having a strong economic base would magnify his power later.
Lord Arius, I want you to select 100 of your priests, young enough to be zealous, old enough to have absorbed the basics, and send them out to every satrapy and spread the good news of the coming freedom. Concentrate on the cities. Send natives where possible. Let them know what kind of opposition they'll face. Expect martyrs in Dazen's cause and begin preparing another wave of zealots. I want regular reports, and send handlers with them. We'll contract the Order of the Broken Eye where persecution is too great, yes?
Lord Arius bowed. He was a Tashian, with his people's typical bright blue eyes, olive skin, and a plaited beaded beard.
My prince, how would you like us to proceed on Big Jasper and in the Chromeria itself?
The Chromeria, you leave alone. Others will handle that. Big Jasper should be handled with utmost care. I want our people there to be more eyes and ears than mouths, you understand? Your best people only on Big Jasper. I want them to grumble in the taverns and the markets, or join those who are already grumbling, barely whispering that our cause must have some merit. Identify those with grievances whom we might recruit, but take greatest care. They're not fools there. Expect the Chromeria to try to plant spies.
Will you authorize the order there?
The order's best people are already there, or on their way there. But I expect you to use them like a needle, not a cudgel. Understood? If our operations are exposed too early, the whole enterprise is doomed. The fate of the revolution lies in your hands.
I believe I should base my own operations from Big Jasper, then.
Agreed.
And I'll need financing.
Which, quite predictably, is where we run into problems. I can give you 10,000 dinars. I know it's a fraction of what you'll need, but I have people who need to be fed. Be creative.
15,000 simply buying a house on Big Jasper.
Make do. I'll send more in 3 months if I can.
Most of the rest of the day was more mundane. Orders for how the army was to camp and where, money requests for food and new clothing and new shoes and new horses and new oxen, and money owed to smiths and miners and foreign lords and bankers who wanted their loans repaid. Others came asking to be authorized to press the locals and the camp followers into service, clearing roads, putting out fires, and rebuilding bridges. Alone out of the advisors, Liv was never asked to consult on anything. The bursar was consulted most often. She wore gigantic corrective lenses and carried a small abacus that she was constantly worrying. Or at least, Liv thought she was merely nervously fidgeting with the abacus. After a while, as the woman gave a report about a dozen different ways the prince could structure his debt so as to maximize his own take, Liv realized that the little woman was doing figures ceaselessly. Finally, the prince asked one of the advisors to tell him what other business was waiting, and deemed that it could all keep until tomorrow. He dismissed the rest of his advisors, and beckoned Liv to join him. Together, they walked upstairs, and out onto the great balcony from his room.
So, Oliviana Danavis, what did you see today?
My lord, I saw that governing is a lot more complicated than I ever would have imagined.
I did more for Garriston today, and more for Tyria, than the Chromeria has done in 16 years. Not that everyone will thank me for it. Forced labor to clean up the city won't be popular, but it's better than letting the goods rot or be taken away by looters and gangs.
Yes, my lord.
He took out a thin cigarro of tobacco rolled inside a ratweed skin from a pocket in his cloak. He touched it to a finger full of some bread to light it. She looked at him curiously.
My transition from flesh to Luxin wasn't perfect. I've done better than anyone in centuries. But I still made mistakes. Painful mistakes. Of course, starting from a charred husk didn't make things any easier.
What happened to you?
Some other time, perhaps. I want you to think about the future, Oliviana. I want you to dream.
The Color Prince looked out over the bay. It was clotted with garbage, the docks littered.
This is the city we've taken. The jewel of the desert that the Chromeria did its best to destroy.
My father was trying to protect it.
Your father's a great man, and I have no doubt that's exactly what he thought he was doing. But your father believed the Chromeria's lies.
I think he was blackmailed.
The prism she'd so admired had used Liv to blackmail her father into helping him. She didn't even know how, but it was the only thing she could imagine had brought her father to fight for his sworn enemy.
I hope that's true.
What?
Because if it's so, it isn't too late for him. And I'd love to have your father stand at our side. He's a dangerous man. A good man. Brilliant. We'll find out. But I'm afraid, Liv, that he's been listening to their lies for so long that his whole system of understanding has been corrupted. He might see a few weeds on the surface and reject those. But if the soil itself is fouled, how can he see the truth? This is why the young are our hope. Liv, I want you to think of a world without the Chromeria. A world where a woman can worship whichever god she sees fit. Where being a drafter isn't a death sentence with a 10-year wait. A world in which an accident of birth doesn't put fools on thrones, but where a man's abilities and drive are all that determines his success. No lords, but those whose nature establishes them. No slaves at all. Slavery is the curse of the Chromeria. In our new world, a woman won't be despised because she came from Tyria. No, nor will it be a badge of honor. I'm not fighting to make Tyria supreme. In our new world, it simply won't matter. Your hair, your eyes, whatever it is that sets you apart will merely make you interesting. We will be a light to the world. We will open the ever-dark gates that Lucidonius closed and cut passes through the Sharazan Mountains. We will welcome all. In every village and every town, magic will be taught, and we'll find that many, many more people have talents that can be used to better their lives and the lives of those around them. It won't be in the corrupt hands of governors and satraps. As we learn, I think we'll find that everyone has been kissed by light. Someday everyone will draft. Think what geniuses of magic are out there even today. Geniuses who could change the world. But right now, maybe they're Tyrian, and they can't afford to go to the Chromeria. They're Parian, and the Dea doesn't like their family. They're Elysian, and they're mired in superstition about magic being evil. Think of the fields that lie fallow. Think of children starving for the bread that they don't have, because they don't have green drafters to fertilize the crops. The Chromeria has their blood on its hands, and none of them even realize it. It's a quiet death, a slow poison. The Chromeria has drained the life from the satrapies one drop of blood at a time. That's our fight, Oliviana. For a different future. And it won't be easy. Too many people gain too much from the current corruption for them to give it up easily. And they'll send the people to die for them. And it breaks my heart. They'll sacrifice the very people we want to set free. But we'll stop them. We'll make sure they can't do it again. That generations yet unborn receive a better world than the one we have.
Everything you're saying sounds good, but the proof's in the eating, isn't it?
Yes. And this is what I want from you, Liv. Draft. Right now. Superviolet. And think. And tell me what you're thinking. You won't be punished, regardless.
Liv did, soaking up that alien invisible light and letting it course through her, feeling it peel her away from her emotions to a hyper-rationality, an almost disembodied intelligence.
You're a practical man. Perhaps a romantic, too. An odd combination. But you've been accomplishing tasks all day, and I wonder if I'm not merely the last on the list. I can't tell if this is the prelude to a seduction, or if you simply like the admiration of women.
Part of her was appalled at what she'd said. The presumption. But instead of yielding to her blushes, she huddled deeper in the Superviolet's dispassion.
Rare is the man who won't swoon over women swooning over him.
So I'm trivially correct on the latter.
He enjoyed her attention, her growing awe, but he had barely touched her, even when he had excuses to do so. He didn't lean toward her as they spoke. He was engaged intellectually, but not bodily.
Ah, but this is no seduction.
He didn't look entirely pleased.
Alas, the fire that took so much else has denied me the simpler pleasures of the flesh. And not that I despise such, but no cavorting like a green for me.
Between the immobilization caused by the burn scars on his face and the immobilization of the Luxons he was weaving into his skin, it was difficult to read any but the most overt expressions on his face, but she reminded herself that this didn't mean he didn't feel readily or deeply. His eyes swirled freely with colors, but Liv thought they too were only good indications of his emotions when he felt something strongly. It made him something of a cipher. Superviolet loved ciphers. Cracking ciphers.
Do you know who I was?
No.
And I'm not going to tell you. Do you know why?
Because you don't want me to know?
No. Because Superviolets love digging up secrets. And if I don't set you to work digging up something that doesn't matter to me, you might be smart enough to dig up something that does.
Diabolical.
Luxon shot out of him, slamming into her chest. She staggered, lost her grip on Superviolet, and found something tight around her neck. Kicking, Liv realized she'd been lifted off her feet. No, not just off her feet. She was suspended off the edge of the balcony, held by a fist of Luxon around her entire head. She grabbed at the fist, trying to pull herself up, trying to loosen its grip, panicking, not even realizing that loosening its grip was the last thing she ought to want. If she fell from this height, she'd die. Her head felt hot, all the veins bulging, her eyes feeling like they'd explode. The color prince's eyes were stark red, glowing like coals. He blinked. Yellow flooded to the fore, and she felt herself swung back onto the balcony and released.
The Chromeria has demonized what we do. Literally. They have made us into actual devils, and I won't tolerate those who call good evil and evil good. I reacted badly.
Liv was shaking and embarrassed of it. She thought she was going to cry and was furious with herself for it. She was a Danavis. She was brave and strong, and she would not break down like a little girl. She was a woman, 17 years old enough to have children of her own. She would not break down. She stood and curtsied, wobbling only a little.
My apologies, my lord. I didn't mean to offend.
You needn't be embarrassed of the trembling. It's the body's reaction. I've seen the most fearless veterans do the same. Your embarrassment of it makes it look like weakness. Ignore it. It passes.
Painting a placid expression on her face, as if it were the stark lines of coal, Liv drafted Superviolet. It helped. She folded her arms, as if against the evening chill, but really to bury their shaking.
So, my lord?
So?
So you have a plan for me?
Of course I do.
And you're not going to tell me what it is?
Such a smart girl. I'm going to assign you a tutor to answer almost every one of your questions.
Except for that one.
There will be other omissions as well.
Who is this tutor?
You'll know when you see him. Now go. I have grimmer tasks to accomplish before the light dies.
Iron Fist was standing outside Androscal's chambers when Kip came out.
I've seen satraps come out of that room looking worse.
Really?
No, I was trying to cheer you up.
Iron Fist started down the hall, and Kip fell in step beside him.
Kip, I'm inviting you to train for the Blackguard.
Oh, right. Because my father demanded it, not on my own merits.
Kip thought he'd only thought those words, but by the time he said merits, he realized he'd stepped in a big pile of his tongue once again. Iron Fist stopped cold.
You were eavesdropping?
Kip swallowed. Nodded.
Then you know I have to induct you at the end. It's up to you how much of an embarrassment you want to make that for both of us.
It was like someone had put a great chain around Kip's chest, dropped him in the sea, and told him to swim home. Iron Fist headed off once again, and didn't pause or slow as they left the Prism's Tower, and crossed the great yard between the seven great towers of the Chromeria to a broad staircase that disappeared into the ground. As they descended, Kip got a notion of just how massive the Chromeria was. But was it merely the huge towers, the spindles that connected them in midair, and the great yard covered with thousands of people going about all the business of the seven satrapies? All of it extended below the ground as well, into a huge chamber. The ceiling was fully 20 paces above the floor. Each of the seven towers had its roots down here, and yet more entrances. Buildings and storehouses, barracks, inns, and even a few homes crowded the chamber, reaching in many places from floor to ceiling. Some were constructed of stone, others of Luxon. Vibrant colors rioted everywhere, and though the whole area was underground, it was neither dark nor musty. Crystals scintillated in every color like torches, taking sunlight from above and splashing it liberally through the chamber. Great fans set in the ceiling at either side sucked in and blew out air, sending a constant slight breeze over the whole area. There was a great hall in the center, and exercise yards off to one side.
Beginning of each new class, there's a lottery. Some numbers are random, but legacies and those who finish just below the cut of the previous training class get to challenge in last. Big advantage. You fight for your spot, but you only have to fight three times. So if you choose spot 10, you might have to fight 10, 11, and 12. It's only a starting point, though. It's easy to move up in the coming weeks and easier to move down. I can do this much for your father. You get to choose last. Don't choose too high, or you'll pay for it in blood. But don't go too low. We cut the bottom seven each month.
Iron Fist moved purposefully, unfazed by the subterranean splendor. Kip followed, tense. He was squeezing his burned hand. He consciously straightened it, grimaced against the pain. Soon he found himself standing with Iron Fist in front of 49 young men and women. They were all dressed in loose tan shirts and pants. Everyone wore at least one armband, with the color he drafted on his right or left arm. Though Kip knew that women outnumbered men in the Chromeria substantially, this class of potential blackguards had only 10 women. Everyone was older than Kip, but still young. Kip would guess most were 16 to 18 years old. They each had a symbol affixed to their left breast in an old Parian script that Kip could mostly guess at. Numbers. It looked like they were lined up according to that number. Seven lines of seven. Among all the new things to look at, the thing that stuck out to Kip was the look in his new classmates' eyes. They barely even noticed him. They were too busy watching Iron Fist like he was a god. The class's teacher hardly looked less impressed than the rest of them. He was a muscle-bound short man, shaved bald and wearing a sleeveless black uniform that showed off massive biceps. Iron Fist gestured, and the class melted, reforming into a large circle in moments. It wasn't flawless, as a few jostled to move from one place to another, but it was pretty impressive for what Kip knew had to be a fairly new class.
Kip?
Iron Fist gestured that Kip was to step into the circle.
This is Kip Guile. He's joining the class. As you know, that means one of you scrubs will be leaving. The Blackguard is elite. We've no room for deadwood. So, Kip, choose. Fight to 5 minutes or until one combatant cries mercy or is knocked out. As at all testings, inflicting permanent damage on your opponent will result in your expulsion from this class.
Kip knew he was going to lose. He barely understood the rules. The only fighting he'd done in his life had mostly been confined to flailing against Ramir back in their village, and losing, always losing. His greatest skill was taking punishment.
Do you have any questions, or are you ready to choose your place?
So, if you lose, do you swap places with the person who beat you, or do you just move down one spot?
It's not an arithmetic problem, Kip.
But that was precisely what it was.
You move down one.
Kip put on a misty look and gazed into the distance.
I see pain in my future.
He jauntily pointed his forefingers like pistols at the tall, slim young Parian who bore a number one on his chest. No one laughed. Maybe they'd laugh when Kip got his ass beat. The young man stepped into the circle looking concerned for Kip.
Match rules, Commander?
No spectacles.
Kip and number one handed over their spectacles. The young man was a green-blue bichrome.
I mean that both ways, Cruxer.
Cruxer? His name was Cruxer?
Of course, sir. Sir, his bandaged hand. Can I block it?
Don't target it. But if it gets hurt, it gets hurt.
The taller youth nodded quickly and moved opposite of Kip. Kip saw flashes of incredulity on the other students' faces as they looked at him. He supposed he didn't cut much of a figure. No one believed he could win. Hell, he didn't believe he could win.
Lose with dignity, Kip. Lose in a way that will make them respect you for being plucky. Plucky? I'm a moron.
Cruxer looked up and made the triangle. Thumb to right eye, middle finger to left eye, forefinger to forehead. Then he touched the three to his mouth, heart, and hands. The three and the four. Perfect seven. A religious young man. Hopefully he'd remember the virtue of mercy. Cruxer turned and saluted Kip, fists touching over his heart and bowing slightly. Kip returned the salute.
Begin.
The tall youth moved, fast. He was on top of Kip before Kip could react. Then, somehow, the young man had control of Kip's arm and rolled him over. Cruxer's legs scissored around Kip's head. The legs tightened and... darkness. Kip had no idea how long he was out. He blinked rapidly. Everyone was still standing around.
That's one loss. You've got 10 seconds until your next bout.
The second boy was stocky, blue-eyed like Kip. Maybe only half Parian because his skin wasn't much darker than Kip's. He bowed to Kip. Kip returned the bow, wondering what fresh pain was coming his way. Kip and number two circled each other warily, but the boy kept looking up and away from Kip. At first, Kip didn't know why. Then he saw the boy's eyes. There were little wisps of blue appearing and disappearing in the whites of his eyes, down into his body, gathering in his fists. If the boy hadn't been lighter-skinned, Kip wouldn't have been able to see it. It was one of the disadvantages the lighter-skinned had. It was why, nominally, the Blackguard were black. But because they weren't wearing spectacles, the boy could only draft tiny sips of blue light at a time. He had to take his eyes off of Kip, look at one of the blue crystals overhead, take what he could, and look back to Kip. Without blue spectacles, it made for a slow process, and Kip, circling slowly, was giving the boy all the time he needed.
Oh, hell.
Kip charged. He threw a punch. It was blocked. The second punch hit the boy's shoulder, but Kip had thrown the punch with his left hand. He felt cuts rip open. It was like he dipped his palm in fire. A fist caught him in the nose. Kip was surprised the boy had let him go rather than press his advantage. Then he realized the reason why the boy would do such a thing. A blue staff was forming in the boy's hands, slowly stretching out like molten glass. Kip darted in and grabbed at the unfinished staff. He caught it, and as his fingertips sank into the crystallizing structure, he felt suddenly as connected to it as if he'd drafted it himself. He could feel the other boy through the open Luxon, his will so focused a moment before, now scattered and confused by Kip's invasion. Kip tore the staff away from the boy and sealed it. The blue Luxon staff was bent from where the boys had grappled for it, but it was still as tall as either of them, and as big around as Kip could comfortably hold in his hand. Ignoring the pain as he grabbed it with his bandaged left hand, Kip swung the bottom of the staff for the boy's knees. Kip stepped over him, putting one end of the staff on the boy's throat.
Match!
Kip stepped away. Drafting blue made it much easier to obey orders than drafting green did.
Commander, sir, what was that?
Something we don't teach until a year from now. Kip, who showed you that?
Kip turned his hands up, helpless.
Will jacking or will breaking? Trainer Fisk?
The muscle-bound teacher stepped forward.
Technically, it's called force translucification. Luxon has no memory. There is no your Luxon or my Luxon. Once a drafter makes physical contact with open Luxon of a color that she can draft, she can use it. What happened here was two drafters fought will to will. Kip broke Grasner's will.
But I didn't know what he was doing!
He didn't know what he was doing either, did you, Kip?
No, sir.
You're just lucky you weren't left a blithering idiot, Graz.
Blithering, no. Idiot? Well...
So, Adrastia, you want to challenge Kip?
Oh, hells!
He was the one who made the crack about Grasner.
Sir, I thought if I won, I was done!
Whatever would make you believe such a thing? The winning is just the beginning.
Kip swallowed. Adrastia didn't look terribly pleased to be fighting Kip, either. Alone of all the fighters, he wasn't wearing an armband showing what color he drafted. He had straight, shoulder-length dark hair, bound back with a gold scarf. Skin just dark enough for the blackguard, with Atashian features and striking blue eyes. Short and slender, but wearing a baggy shirt and baggy pants, he looked maybe 13 years old. Odd haircut, but then Kip wasn't exactly a man of the world. Maybe long hair was in fashion now. Strange name, too. And rather full lips.
Oh! You're a girl!
Iron Fist rubbed his forehead.
No mercy, Chops.
Now he could tell she was his age. 15, maybe 16. Petite, no curves. Fairly pretty, but no knockout. He hoped she wasn't a knockout, anyway.
Form up! Same rules as before, and no will jacking. But then, that shouldn't be a problem with you, Tia, should it?
Adrastia grimaced toward the trainer, face intense. She turned toward Kip, gave a very perfunctory bow. Kip bowed back.
Oh, sorry, I didn't...
Save it, Lord Guile.
Oh, I get it. You're jealous, because I have bigger boobs than you.
I can see you naked, and I'm not jealous of that.
Huh?
But Kip didn't have time to think about what she could possibly mean, because she attacked him. He wasn't in a ready stance, and he wasn't ready, period. Especially not for her foot to go from the floor to the side of his head in the blink of an eye. Kip was looking at the world sideways. He was lying down, without having been aware of the whole falling part. As ever when hurt, he did a quick inventory. Just how bad was it? Not that bad. He bit the hell out of his cheek and tongue, but he'd gone down mostly from the surprise. Getting your head torn off by a little girl will do that to you. She came into his view, still in a fighting stance.
Is this all you've got?
It enraged her, and she stepped toward him. He rolled toward her, fast, hoping to catch her feet and trip her. She jumped, trying to leap over him, but he slowed, grabbed one foot while she was in midair. He got lucky and snagged the inside foot. Kip scrambled, trying to pin her, something, anything to use his weight to win somehow. He was halfway on top of her when her small fist caught him straight in the throat. In a moment, he was lying face down, and she was on top of him with her arm around his neck.
Enough!
Then Adrastia disappeared as Iron Fist lifted her bodily off him, literally hauling her off by her collar. Iron Fist dropped the furious girl in front of him.
I said enough!
Adrastia was shocked to stillness. Then she wilted. Everyone in the class shrank back, wide-eyed.
Kip!
Yes, sir!
All the scrubs have a partner. You just found yours.
At dinner, Kip took his food and sat at the end of a long table by himself. You can't get rejected if you don't try to fit in. Adrastia came over and sat across from him.
I'm supposed to spy on you.
Good sausage?
It's not bad. You should see what the full blackouts get.
Good?
Fantastic. I'm serious.
You really love food, huh?
I mean about the spying sheet for brains.
I know.
Oh.
Why does anyone want to spy on me?
You're a guile.
She shrugged, as if that explained everything. Kip supposed it did.
Who are you spying for?
My sponsor, of course.
Well, I sort of figured. But who's your sponsor?
That's a kind of personal question, isn't it?
You're spying on me, but I don't get to ask you slightly personal questions.
It's not really a personal question, Kip. I was just testing you.
So does that mean you're going to tell me?
Tell you what?
Oh, you really are impossible, aren't you?
Lady Lucretia Verengeti of the Smusato Verengetis is my sponsor.
You're from Alita? You don't look Elysian. Plus, I thought the Elysians don't like drafting and heretics and all.
You just say the first thing that pops into your head, don't you?
I'm getting better.
This is the better?
Maybe I'll just shut my fat face for the rest of my life. Tell you what. How about... You tell me about you, and that way I can spend a few seconds not getting myself into trouble.
What's there to tell? Father's a merchant sailor, does the spice silk circuit when he can. Gone more often than not. Mother's a brewer in Odis. She wanted me to take over the stills. Instead, here I am.
Isn't Odis in Nabonia?
Head of the Narrows, one of the biggest cities in the world.
So how come your sponsor's Elysian?
Because she's the one who bought me last.
Kip tried not to let his surprise show. She tapped the top of her ear. It was snipped vertically and cauterized.
You not see this?
Oh.
She was a slave, and he was stupid.
They like to say that among the Chromeria's pupils, there's no slave and no free. They like to say all sorts of things, of course. But if you can make it into the Blackguard, it's actually true.
So that's why you're trying to get into the Blackguard?
You're joking, right?
Kip's look must have been enough.
Do you know why almost everyone in our training group is older than you, Kip?
Do you see this blank look on my face? Assume it applies for everything.
Getting a spot in the Blackguard is the most coveted appointment most of us can dream of. In our training group alone, there are four legacies, children of Blackguards. Kruxa, Rig, Aram, and Tana. I can guarantee you that all of them have been training in martial arts since they could walk. If you're a slave and you test in, you're freed. Though you do have to swear your service to the Blackguard. If you're the owner of that slave, the Chromeria pays you a fortune for the transfer of your property. The Verengetis have placed dozens of Blackguards over the years. It's one of their more lucrative businesses. I came in a little sideways. The family that owned me had a daughter who was my age. They wanted her to be able to defend herself. I was trained with her so she'd have a sparring partner. When they realized I might be able to draft, they sold me to Lady Verengeti. She had me train for the last year, all day, every day, with a variety of top masters, so that I might make it in.
Oh, so you're telling me I shouldn't feel bad for getting beaten up by a girl?
Watch it, Shonky.
He grinned a moment late, not realizing right away that she was teasing. Her face fell.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were since... I shouldn't have... I'm sorry. I heard you almost pass the threshing.
Almost.
Another reminder of failure. But she clearly meant well.
Actually, I've got one special talent.
What's that?
It's a secret. You can't tell anyone. Highly valuable.
All right.
Plate cleaning.
He gestured to his empty plate.
Ta-da!
That one is going right to my sponsor.
She was cute. Damn, she was cute. Her smile punched right through Kip's chest and stirred that same stupid, awful, ridiculous place that Liv had.
Look, I know you're just being nice to me because you've been ordered to, but I like you.
Something died in her eyes. She looked away. He saw a wave of suppressed emotion crest in her lips, which went through about four expressions in a second. She blinked rapidly, stood up, and left without a word.
So, Kip, sweetie, how was your first date? Oh, I made my teacher hate me. I got slapped by an old man and beat up by a little girl. I told my class that you were a whore. I destroyed someone's dream of joining the Blackguard, and I made a nice girl cry. Other than that, great! And my hand hurts.
He pushed his hand against the tabletop, trying to straighten it like he was supposed to be doing all the time. He stopped immediately. Had to concentrate so tears didn't leak out. Kip got up and walked out of the hall. His Blackguard followed him. The man was tall and skinny, his irises haloed in red behind square-lensed red spectacles, pistol tucked behind his back, Adigan on one hip, Katar on the other. He wasn't one of the Blackguards who'd been to Tyria. It wasn't even dark when Kip got to the barracks. He didn't care. He crashed into his bed, not even pulling the blanket over himself. He was finished. But the day wasn't finished with him. Something jabbed him.
What are you doing in my bed?
Really?
Kip didn't even open his eyes.
I'm farting in it to warm it up for you.
Get out! I want to sleep in this bed tonight.
It's a bit small, but I guess we can cuddle.
Kip sat up. The bully was big, but doughy looking. One of those boys who gets his height and weight early, and doesn't really notice when everyone else catches up with him.
Out of my bed, fatty!
Kip rubbed his eyes. The other boys in the barracks were watching, pretending to be readying their bunks, stripping off their tunics.
Problem with being a bully, you never know how tough the new boy is. But it scares you a little, doesn't it?
What? Get out, fatty!
Kip stood up wearily. The bully had short-cropped brown hair, a heavy jaw, big nose, chubby but a big frame.
You think I've never seen a bully before? You think I've never been bullied? We both know how this goes. I'm going to draw a line. Like, don't hit me. And then because you're a bully, you're going to have to hit me. And then...
Or I can sidestep all that nonsense.
Kip punched the bully in the nose as hard as he could.
What's your name?
Ew.
Elio got up on all fours, or all threes, actually, since one hand was occupied.
Elio?
I'm gonna kill you, you little...
Fighting manners dictated that Kip let him stand before they fought. Kip slugged the boy in the face. He jumped on top of Elio, squashing the breath out of him and trapping his arm in a wrist lock.
I'm going to kick your ass, you little puke! I'm going to make you regret the day you were born! Oh, let go of me arm!
Kip nearly ground forward until the boy stopped fighting.
I'm going to kill you, you fat little bastard! You can't hold me forever, and once I get out, you're going to have to watch your back. I'll be there. I'll be waiting for you, and you won't get off with a sucker punch next time.
Kip realized suddenly that he was riding a tiger. There was no winning here. He was in a position of power, so he'd look the bad guy if he used it to his advantage.
Elio, I might not look it, but I'm tougher than you. I'm meaner than you, I'm smarter than you, and I will always go further than you dare.
Oh, save it, shit eater!
Start begging me, now, you little bitch!
Kip was suddenly so tired of it all. What did Iron Fist said?
The winning is just the beginning.
Elio, I was going to give you one more chance to take it back, but you're not going to take anything back. You're too damn stupid, and I'm too tired to keep playing this game. But I want you to remember something. After you go to the infirmary, this is me being merciful.
Still holding Elio's wrist in the wrist lock, Kip brought his left forearm down sharply with his weight behind it. A bit of bloody bone speared through the skin. Kip got off. As 40 boys watched wide-eyed, Elio crawled away, bleeding, weeping. He stood and lurched out of the barracks, cradling his broken arm. None of the boys helped him. No one in authority ever came. As Elio careened out of the door, Kip saw that his blackguard, the slim, tall young man, was standing in the dark corner, leaning against the wall. He'd watched everything, no doubt ready to move if Kip's life were in danger. Other than that, he wouldn't interfere. He just watched, eyes glittering, face blank. With feigned nonchalance, Kip lay back down in his bed and pretended to go back to sleep instantly.
Just leave me alone.
He turned his back toward the boys who were whispering to each other, amazed, repeating the story that didn't need repeating. They'd all seen it. Kip's sleep was a lie. Eventually, the boys snuffed their candles. In the darkness, Kip relived the battle at Garriston. The man he'd thrown into the campfire. Skin tearing off his face like chicken sticking to a pan. The eyes of men, faces contorted with fury, trying to kill Kip, hefting weapons as Kip fell through the gap in the wall. Fell. Feet kicking at him from 100 sides, the taste of gunpowder in the air, the joy of sweeping a blade into a man, his flesh parting, the blade winning free of his flesh, liberating blood and soul. Surrounded by soldiers, matchlocks coming up, kept shooting their own musket balls in their faces. An eyeball blue as the sea sitting on a paving stone. The head it had been blown out of, nowhere to be found. Staring at Kip, staring. Accusing.
Killer. What have you done?
He remembered losing fights to Ramir, the village bully. They'd thought Ramir was going to be pressed into King Haradol's army. Kip had killed soldiers, boys, no older than Ramir at Garriston. Boys who'd probably been pressed into service. Innocents, doing guilty work. He thought he wanted to kill Ramir, sometimes, back when he was a boy. Back when he didn't know what it meant. Back when he didn't know how easy it was.
What kind of monster have I become?